Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson. And once again, I have Rowan Kent back in the building to talk about his most recent article. Rowan, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
You know, it's the beginning of summer, which for me means a lot less of one kind of work and a lot more of another. So hard not to be smiling.
Yes, a lot more basketball. Is it doxing? I don't think it's doxing, but I won't dox your regular job. But I'm assuming that the more of is the basketball conversation, which we certainly are about to have quite a bit of.
Yeah, I'm excited to have more of these. It's really the month for us. And honestly, even though it's the month for us, like this is the work that we've been doing all year. So I'm excited to have this conversation and a lot more in June.
So let's get started in breaking down the article. So you wrote for Tuesday, so yesterday, by the time this episode is coming out, about Jalen Williams of Auburn. No, not the Jalen Williams that plays for the Oklahoma City Thunder, but the Jalen Williams that is still a college student, which, you know, we'll get into the sort of, you know, hilarity of that in a moment. But I did want to start with someplace a little bit more general, which is, for those of you that don't know who Jalen Williams is, he is a graduate student, fifth year player at Auburn, and he's the archetype of kind of player that I think the discussion about the kind of player that he is kind of only falls along one line, which is the, oh, he's an older prospect. You know, you want to go for the right, like draft the 19-year-old with potential rather than the 24-year-old. Right. But I think there's an important conversation to be had about the fact that Jalen Williams has gone through so many different iterations of teams at Auburn, which you break down in wonderful detail in the piece. But I'm curious sort of about that aspect of things. What is it? Well, first of all, we'll get into, you know, why you decided to write about Jalen Williams specifically, but what are your thoughts on the sort of archetype of player that he is as someone who, you know, I think a lot of the time when you're talking about NBA players, they were the best player on their high school team. Most of them were the best player or the second best player on their college team. And so there's an adjustment for a lot of guys, you know, more, I think, scoring focused guys, but really everybody who has to figure out, okay, you know, if I'm not the LeBron James or Luka Doncic of the world, I have to figure out how to fit into a context with other players. And that's certainly that Jalen Williams has a lot of experience with. Whereas, you know, if you're taking that 19-year-old who maybe had, you know, one season in a smaller role at college and might have disappointed, but they're still getting drafted on potential, you know, there's less of a sort of idea of, okay, how will that transition work when now they're no longer one of the guys and they have to fight for a spot rather than, you know, if you're one of the top high school guys and obviously we're the best guy on your team, you're going to have some sort of role on whatever college team you go to, even if it doesn't exactly go as planned.
Yeah, I think when I was looking for this next player to write about, I think that it's fascinating to consider an archetype that is outside, as you're mentioning, ones that evaluators often look for. It's really appealing to watch some of the star talent, but stars are few and far between at any league. More often you have players who play a reduced role regardless of their talent level, and they've chosen to just take a bit less on their plate to make sure that everyone gets fed. I think that especially, and it's kind of interesting this week as well, you can start to look at more of these type of players right after the withdrawal deadline happens. There are a number of guys who you might have a higher grade on that decide to go back for NIL, for increased opportunities, for whatever reasons. And then the board changes. Guys that you might have thought this would be a really good role player and might be someone that is worthy of UDFA or is worthy of some two-way looks suddenly it makes a lot more sense for them to be taken by a team that needs someone to fill the shoes on the fifth starter, the sixth man, seventh, eighth. There's a lot of value you get from guys like Jalen Williams, like Isaiah Crawford, who's slowly risen up boards this year, and to mention him, like, really good defenders, guys who can make plays, will do the dirty work that the stars then don't have to. I mean, you look at Derek Jones Jr. or PJ Washington. While they might not have had similar long-term, like, arcs, they're playing roles in the NBA that you look for older players who are ready to accept that. And so it's a valuable archetype. The more I watch Jalen Williams in just a general board context, the harder it would be not to write about him, because he was a lot of fun. There's so much to dig into with him that it just happened pretty naturally.
I think that this also can sort of tie back to the conversation that I had with Rucker last week on this feed about, you know, looking for the hope in the 2024 draft class. And a lot of that is, you know, first of all, you know, there's sort of the up top element of, you know, even the worst draft classes that we've seen had at least three all-stars, which, you know, you're going to get three all-star guys, but the vast majority of even the best draft classes, right? Like even the 2003 draft class, which had nine all-stars, which was the most in the sample that Rucker covered from 2000 to 2020, you know, the bulk of the class was just guys who carved out long NBA careers. You know, a decent chunk of those were, you know, starter level guys, whether that be, you know, a third starter or a fifth starter, you know, sort of depending, right? But a lot of, you know, what we sort of talk about with the, you know, value of a draft class is how many depth guys there are. And, you know, even in the class that had three all-stars, you know, there were a bunch of guys who carved out long-term roles for an NBA team. And so then the question becomes, okay, well, you know, if there are only going to be three all-stars in the 2024 class, and, you know, history would tell us that the number one pick is almost certainly going to be an all-star, and, you know, somewhere between three and five, there's usually one of the other all-stars. And then, you know, the third all-star is, you know, somewhere later down in the class, right? By the time you get to the second round, I mean, I can't go a full podcast without talking about Isaiah Thomas being the 60th overall pick and, you know, making a couple all-star teams and an all-NBA team. But ultimately, you know, when you're talking about the value of a draft class, a lot of it is in, wow, our team really needs an eighth man, a backup big man who can play great defense, who doesn't need the ball in their hands to be effective on offense, who can make the right play. You know, certainly nowadays there's an element of, if they're not, you know, going to be a five, you really want them to try and space the floor to some aspect, right? You know, a lot of that is, and this is something I come back to all the time, because I've always been fascinated with how Jay Crowder was, you know, ACC Player of the Year and, you know, 4-year senior, came from a community college, but had, you know, sort of a very obvious, in my mind anyway, translation to, hey, this guy can play basketball really well, right? It's like, you know, maybe he's got more of a power forward skill set and he's 6'6 on a good day, but you put him out there, he'll figure out ways to be effective. And that's, I think, you know, the real interest with Jalen Williams is, okay, you know, he's not someone who's going to go in the lottery. He's almost certainly not someone who's going to go in the first round, but when you're talking about second round picks, just getting someone who's on the NBA roster for more than a cup of coffee is usually a win. And, you know, ultimately, a lot of those guys are going to be, okay, is this someone who can play a role, who has shown a willingness to play a role, and who plays a role that's helpful for us, right? And so that's, you know, Jay Crowder going in the second round when, you know, there were a lot fewer than 32 players picked ahead of him who had, you know, long-term valuable NBA careers. If that's the kind of path that Jalen Williams is going down, then, you know, I think that's a lot less important than, oh, you know, he was a 5-year college player, right? You know, it's like, okay, but can he contribute value for us? Because if you draft a 19-year-old who, you know, was the primary scorer on their high school team and didn't quite adjust to being a primary scorer in college and then never figures it out, right? Like, you know, maybe cynically as a GM, you can say, well, you know, we drafted the young guy with potential. Don't fire me yet. Give him a few more years to figure it out. But what's actually going to be a valuable, you know, contribution to your team is getting someone who can potentially be that eighth man, who you're confident can translate into being a role player rather than just if they don't have the ball in their hands, they're not helping.
Yeah, I think that when looking at those type of immediate hits, not the ones that you'd want right away, the more that I looked into what Jalen Williams does, not what his like limitations, what the age would be, looking at what he does, I almost wanted to send multiple times to the No Ceilings chat, just someone pour cold water on how I'm feeling on Jalen Williams. Someone provide the more rational take, because the more I looked at what his role could be and the skills that he can fit into, I've written about Anton Watson in like a skeleton key format, and I won't go as far for what Jalen Williams does, but he fits into a lot of roles that teams need to win. And he can soak up minutes that teams can use to win basketball games. And there can be whatever thoughts around, would you want to take a bigger swing? Would you want to take this? There's really not a lot of arguments I can find for if you're a team that would want a guy to come in and play a role that you have in mind, not one that he would grow into. He's played a lot of roles, so he can fit into a few different ones really well. I obviously still need the cold water. It really would surprise me if he didn't either like get drafted or didn't like play pretty early in his tenure in the NBA.
So let's go from the general into the specific, and I'm going to start out with the specifics on Jalen Williams by just quoting you directly from the article. So here we go. I've dubbed Jalen Williams the soon-to-be third of his namesake in the NBA, side note, that's a wild statement to make, as a sleeper agent for this class. No, I don't think Williams will hear a specific string of numbers and activate his clandestine orders. Side to Winter Soldier style. Instead, with a relative lack of buzz, I can't believe Williams isn't rocketing up more draft boards and knocking on the door of serious draft consideration. And this, I think, goes back to, you know, a point that you made earlier of, you know, it's been a few days, but we're still sort of vaguely in the aftermath of the early entrant withdrawal deadline. And, you know, so with that in mind, a lot of guys who are auto eligible, a lot of the guys who stayed in the draft, you know, you have to look at, as you mentioned, a bit more seriously. And when you sort of look at it from that perspective, again, you know, it lends into the idea of, hey, Jalen Williams is someone who's, you know, still available for teams. And certainly there are a number of teams that, you know, as with all draft stuff, it's if everything pans out, right? But, you know, he has the skill set where, and this is something that I talk about all the time, of like multiple different avenues to being a successful NBA player, right? It's not just, you know, even someone who I have a clear first round grade, I actually have a top 20 grade on Tyler Smith, but Tyler Smith is locked positionally as a power forward and he is not yet ready to contribute on the defensive end. I think that's a generous way to put it. And so, you know, the idea is, you know, he's an above average athlete. He'll be great in transition. He'll be great as a trail 3-point shooter. He'll be great, you know, as someone who, you know, can shoot off movement as a 6'10 power forward type. You know, great. There are a lot of teams that you could use that kind of player, but you know, if any of those things don't particularly work out, like if his cold shooting down the stretch of the season proves to be closer to who Tyler Smith is than, you know, his hot shooting to start the season, you don't really have anything. I mean, not nothing, but you don't have very much to fall back on. Whereas with Jalen Williams, you know, and we'll get into this later in the piece, right? But he had his best season by far as a 3-point shooter this year. If that doesn't turn out to be the level of shooter that he is, he can fall back on the defense. He can fall back on his incredible scoring game around the basket, right? There are more ways that you could see Jalen Williams getting 10 minutes a game than ways that I could see Tyler Smith getting 20 minutes a game. And, you know, if Tyler Smith works out, you know, the reason I have a much higher grade on him is because if he works out, he could, you know, potentially be a low end starter or, you know, higher in the rotation guy, right? But there's only really one kind of path for him to do that. Whereas with Jalen Williams, there are multiple different avenues where you could see, okay, he becomes, you know, a defense first guy who just lives off garbage buckets around the basket, or okay, he turns into this, you know, 3-and-D stretch power forward type, right? There are multiple ways it could work out, which I think makes it more interesting to sort of think through the idea of, all right, because there are more ways that this could work out, there are going to be more teams that are interested.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up if you didn't, but just based on the fact that he is a bit more malleable than maybe some more naturally talented, maybe some more higher upside guys, it wouldn't surprise me in this next month when teams start to put out their little blurbs of who's coming in for workouts, or when Portland or Indiana does an interview or a video, like to start to see Jalen Williams's name crop up even more. He is the type of player that you can fit into a number of different square, circle, like peg holes for him to contribute in those ways. And again, I dubbed him a sleeper agent because this is a really valuable archetype. Players who can live outside of the regular ecosystem of where you'd fit on the basketball court, that has value. That has value, maybe not in the way of it will carry ticket sales or get you trips to the All-Star game. It carries value in organizations with winning, and especially for someone like Jalen Williams, who is a graduate who's played for a number of years in college, it really helps his chances of not only like making it to the NBA, but being able to stick around and get towards a second contract in the long run.
So let's go into the background info that you have for the piece. And, you know, we've sort of teased and worked around this, but, you know, sort of get into the specifics of it here. You know, he was a top 100 recruit. He didn't play much his first year at Auburn, but, you know, his sophomore year, he was a regular starter, and he was starting alongside names you might have heard of, you know, Sharif Cooper, Alan Flanagan, JT Thor. And then when Jabari Smith showed up, he accepted a bench role. And that, I think, is critical to this evaluation, because it goes back to, you know, what I was talking about earlier, right? Of it's not just that you have to imagine a world in which Jalen Williams is willing to accept a smaller role to make things work. You've seen it. He's already done it, right? It's not like, gosh, I hope that, you know, this guy who chucks up a shot every time the ball touches his hands can learn to be a bit more pass happy at the NBA level. And, you know, to be fair, that does happen sometimes. I mean, you know, it's a bit unfair, but Rob Dillingham, for me, going into the year, went from someone who's like, I wish he would pass the ball more, to, wow, he's actually a pretty good passer. This is great. This is awesome. Like, I so much easier to see him fitting in to an NBA team now that he's actually more willing to pass the ball, right? But there's a difference between, you know, in theory, it would be great if, and we've already seen it happen.
Yeah, I think that when I had noticed, you know, starting to do a deeper dive on Williams, whenever you see a player go from starting a lot of games to playing a different role, your mind can go to injuries. It can go to all sorts of different explanations. And there is an article up on Auburn's like school website where it goes and talks about how Jalen like did accept that role. And that is really a great thing that like him, he should be championing. Teams should know in their own research and really put as a feather in his cap. He was able to recognize like what was best for the team. He was still playing in practice against Jabari Smith, against Walker Kessler. Like, I'm not a practice Puritan, but it's really important to be getting a lot of good play time, and he is against that NBA talent. And then that trust that he earned from Bruce Pearl, he gets to bank on that in the next two seasons. He gets to then start, I think, all but one game. He's improving across the board. There's skills that he wasn't as good at earlier in his career that he now gets to show, and it all comes together in this fifth year, and is a really big testament to his work ethic, to who he is as a person, and who he's going to be as a basketball player at that next level, which is really exciting.
So let's now dig into some of the skill specifics, and where you start with the piece is interior offense and interior defense. And so let's start where you start with the defense, because, you know, again, we talked sort of earlier about multiple potential avenues to NBA success for Williams, but I think it's going to be the kind of thing where, you know, some players earn their way onto the floor with their offense, and then they just need to be good enough defensively for that to play up to the NBA level, right? For Williams, and correct me if I'm wrong, you certainly have done more of a deep dive than I have on him, but, you know, he's someone who I think will earn his way onto the court with his defense. And then the question becomes, can he fill enough other gaps offensively that, and, you know, certainly there are coaches who we can name, cough, Tom Thibodeau, cough, cough, who, if you don't play defense, you don't earn your way onto the court in the first place, right? So if Williams, you know, can establish himself as a, you know, interior presence defensively, then I think that's where, you know, all right, this is how you get to be, right, like the 10th man. This is how you get to be, you know, someone who's, you know, maybe trusted in garbage time to start out and can earn your way into more minutes. I think defense is maybe not, you know, unlike for Tyler Smith, where shooting is kind of the only avenue, it's maybe not the only avenue for Jalen, but I think it's the easiest one to see.
And even his interior defense, I wanted to touch on it first, mostly like tease out his quality of defense since I like his perimeter defense a bit more. But one of the earliest memories I have in the season for Jalen Williams as a defender was in writing my article on Khalil Ware and watching it. One of his tougher games was against Auburn. And when I had first expected it to be Jani Broome that was giving him a lot of issues, more often than not, Jalen Williams was guarding him in the post, was harassing his shots. And in the full dive for my article on Jalen Williams, he is a pretty imposing shot blocker for a guy who has more of that like wing or forward size. I'm not here saying that he can reliably play backup 5 minutes. And yet you see players like Aaron Gordon, or even more recently, like in a different context, but Obi Toppin as a smaller player getting to play backup 5 minutes for the Pacers in this playoff run. There is at least the versatility and the utility that Williams can play. I know maybe his block percentage has gone down, but it's still at a good number for a player for his size. And I think that more speaks to how much more he's doing in other ways, that instead of just being deployed like he might be in the NBA as more of an interior finishing and defending weapon, he had to do a little bit more, but he still showed that in a lot of his swats when he was ruining people's days at the rim at Auburn.
So I'm sort of curious your thoughts on this. You know, you sort of mentioned the change in responsibilities. Was it, you know, him being sort of thrown more on switches? Because as we'll get into in a minute, there's a lot to like with his perimeter defense. Is it more of just, you know, him spending more time on the perimeter? Because certainly you would expect anyone's block percentage to dip when they're playing alongside Walker Kessler. But, you know, for that to also be slightly lower over the last couple of years, I'm curious if that, you know, seems to be more of a focus on perimeter defense rather than, you know, being sort of around the cup as much on the defensive end.
I think it's both the real skill that he brings, that it would limit his real ability to affect the game to just keep him by the basket. He, as I touch on later in the article, when he is switching, and they did do a lot of like zone possession, so it's not like a true switching on pick and rolls, but being able to navigate through what teams are doing, it was sometimes like he could just like slip through walls. Like I said, sleeper agent, but even more like a ghost, he could just get through what teams were trying to prevent him to do. And so I think Bruce Pearl, by the time that he had Broome, by the time that he was starting to build out a different team context, wanted to keep putting Jalen Williams in positions to succeed, keep putting the Auburn team into the best configuration. So I think it's both that like he has improved, like not only interiorly, but his perimeter defense is that good. And it's another case of him doing what the team needs, that he is staying more on the move because that's where they can be stingier.
So we've talked about the at rim defense, and you mentioned the idea of being able to phase through walls, where the area where I think it's most fun to see him sort of, you know, wildly finding ways through is, you know, his scoring around the basket. And this is fun for me. I mean, you say it in the piece, there's no better way to describe Williams's finishing talent than wonky regarding layups and post moves. And this is one that's always fun. I mean, you know, nowadays, I think, you know, the key example that people point to is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander of, you know, finds weird ways to finish around people. For me, the one that will always stick with me as, you know, the player who first caught my attention in the draft space was Caris LeVert, as someone who had a funky dribble rhythm and, you know, sort of found his way around guys in ways that you wouldn't expect, which, you know, I think it's the kind of thing that's really interesting because maybe some players are more reluctant to sort of try that out because it looks weird and it looks terrible if it doesn't go in. But the flip side of that is I feel like those shots get blocked a lot less because nobody has any idea where the hell they're coming from.
Yeah, I was thinking along the same lines. I think basketball is both an art and a science in the really cliche way, because there's a beauty to how you can get to your spots. You can move in a rhythm, or you can, as we're talking about with Karis, with Shea, you disrupt the rhythm with the way that you play. It's a science in the way of, at the end of the day, it is a percentage game too. You're trying to score more points, and I don't think teams will be as concerned on the aesthetics of some of Jalen Williams's finishes as they will be on, dang, he's finishing a lot of these, and we can trust him when the clock is running down and he has that chance at the rim to just put it down. I think that even though they're more unusual to watch, he's using a solid process on them. Like, he's for more of his hook shots or in the post, the defender's on his opposite shoulder. They can't contest as easily. And while it might look like something where he wasn't as totally refined as like a Kyrie Irving finish, where he's perfectly weighted each part of the move to then get the result, I think that there is like some definite planning, some counters that Jalen Williams is using. And it's really hard to argue that when you look at the numbers too. He's a tenacious finisher. He brings strength, length, and a lot of those results there. And yeah, they're wonky, but I think that that's even a little more endearing and great to see that he can finish in unusual ways. I had written about Trey Alexander earlier in like this draft cycle, and some of his finishing concerns, he could finish some of the more difficult ones, and then against more standard like rim defense, it was a bit more difficult to see that path. Jalen Williams can finish if you've made the defense hard, easy, if he's on or off balance, and that's really valuable for a guy like him.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, the Trey Alexander conversation is interesting, but I do want to focus on Jalen Williams because I wrote about Trey Alexander for No Ceilings Project in the works, let's put it that way. But yeah, with Jalen, I think it's fascinating in the sense that there are multiple ways to create space for your shot, right? And I think, you know, a lot of times there's sort of the, you know, you mentioned Kyrie Irving, right? Like, oh, you know, this is the sort of traditional, more aesthetically pleasing way to, you know, create space, you know, bump off the defender, fade away, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, ultimately what matters most is, you know, okay, can I create the space that I need? And maybe it's not even the space that I need as much as just, can I get the defender to hesitate for long enough for me to get my arm to the weird angle that, you know, I as Jalen Williams need to finish. And part of that is, you know, basketball IQ of reading the game, of being able to say, okay, you know, if I go over my left shoulder, defender is going to expect the hook shot from the left. So, you know, any sort of way that you can get a defender on their back foot. And sometimes, you know, it's, I know that this shot is coming and there's absolutely nothing I can do to stop it. Right. And then sometimes that's what is this guy do? Oh, the ball's already in, you know, it's like any way that you can sort of create that space for yourself, whether it be, again, you know, a more sort of traditional aesthetically pleasing way, or just, you know, finding your way into a shot that maybe the defender has no idea it's coming, but I've practiced that, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times, whatever. I know how to, you know, get that angle. What matters is getting the angle, right? It's not as much how it looks, but certainly, as you mentioned, for me, I am very endeared by the players that finish in the way that Jalen Williams does, and the way that Caris LeVert does, and the way that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander does, because, you know, it's different. It's fun. And I think that's exciting, even if maybe it might be quote unquote ugly by traditional standards of the way that you're supposed to lay the ball in.
Yeah. And look, if you want aesthetically pleasing finishes from Jalen Williams, you turn on the dunk package. If you want to see what he's doing in the purest distillation of what you want out of an interior finisher, you get to the dunks, because in the same way that he's finding his space with his body when he's down low, and even if he's a little off balance, he's still finishing, he's finding space in different ways to get above the rim. And I mean, those were just like a treat to look through, not only because he had a lot, but because I felt like each one that I was watching, it got just a little bit more wild. The level of ridiculousness started to ratchet up on each dunk that he would put down. He would jump from just a bit farther, And I like it's not only scouting, but it's just like it's a little bit of enjoyment on the side there too to get to watch him do his work in that layer of the rim.
And I think that's also an important element of the profile, you know, beyond just it's fun to watch him, you know, throw down thunderous dunks over people, sure. But, you know, there's also the element of, and we'll get into this actually quite a bit more in the next section coming up, but, you know, being an undersized, you know, let's say tweener big man, right? Of like power forward center somewhere in that mix, you know, probably not going to be a wing, right? The, you know, added element of, okay, you know, I'm 2 inches shorter, but I can jump 2 inches higher than that guy, right? It's, you know, it's not exactly the same, especially, you know, given how much of, you know, positioning in the post is, you're not necessarily, you know, getting to your max vertical when you're, you know, trying to defend a guy on a post up. But, you know, ultimately, it's easier to sort of see that mold you mentioned earlier with the Aaron Gordon type, right? Like Aaron Gordon, one of the best vertical athletes we've ever seen, like, yeah, you know, he's not a traditional center, you know, 6'8", 6'9", but he can cover a lot more ground vertically because he's got that athleticism in a way that, you know, maybe if he were a true 7-footer, it would be slightly easier, but you can make up for a lot with that kind of leaping ability.
Yeah. Aaron Gordon also has been playing backup 5. He is getting to be in that like versatile role that his vertical pop allows him to get into. I think both him and Jalen Williams, they have a bit of that innate horizontal feel where they'll creep into spaces to get to these like monster dunks. In the playoff run, I think it was against the Lakers, the one game where Aaron Gordon just went out of his mind to really hurt the Lakers' interior defense. It was off of Jokic's passing, but it was even more so off of Gordon's movement that he could get to the spots that would let him throw down those dunks. Jalen Williams can do the same where even without the ball in his hands, he's getting to places without being going to like finish over a guy based on being taller. He's done it by being smarter, being more reflexive and reactive to get there. And that's going to really be something that teams will want a guy to do.
So now that we've talked about the ways in which he could potentially be a small ball center, let's talk about him not being a small ball center at all and move to the next section, which is perimeter offense and defense. And, you know, the way that you start off the section, if Jalen Williams were a center and not a small ball power forward, his proficiency on the perimeter wouldn't matter as much. Since he's 6'8", however, the need to be a skilled perimeter player, perimeter defender and floor spacer is key to his future success. And, you know, I think that goes back to a lot of what we were talking about earlier of, you know, okay, you know, he's got the defense as sort of the calling card and he's great around the basket, which is obviously hugely helpful, but if you're going to have more than one path to the NBA, if you're going to be more than just, all right, you know, he's a drop defender who we hope can cut and, you know, run backdoor lob plays, there has to be a little bit more there. And as you mentioned, luckily, Williams is just as skilled on the perimeter on defense, if not more so, while having some solid shooting touch to draw just enough attention from the opposition. So let's start with the perimeter skill on defense. I do want to make sure to circle back to the shooting touch and the attention it draws, but with the defense, I think that's really going to be a huge part of it because there's one element that's like, okay, you're someone who, you know, is a weak shot blocker who, if they're forced to drop back into the paint, they can cover guys and guard them. And then there's a whole nother element, which is particularly funny because, you know, Jabari Smith featured so prominently in the earlier portion of Jalen Williams' college career of, can he be someone who can absolutely, you know, shut guys down on switches, who you can throw him out on the perimeter and not only feel like I'm vaguely comfortable, it's like I'm not uncomfortable with him switching on the perimeter. It's like I actually might want him there almost as much, if not more, as I want him around the basket.
Yeah, not every team uses switching in their like bread and butter of their defense, but especially when it gets time for the playoffs, teams need to be able to have guys who can switch, who can be isolated on what used to be colloquially known as a mismatch and not just get barbecued. I think that Jalen Williams is the type of player on his defense perimeter wise that he can really bank on those. Like that's the first line of his resume for teams is the tape. I think when you look at, does he generate a lot of steal turnovers? No. But it's almost because he's being a bit more measured. He's sticking to the fundamentals of staying off ball in a good position, not lurching out to use as really good wingspan, but not lurching out to potentially put the defense into a bent position that will then result in an easy bucket. He is a guy who's going to fight through screens, slip through them in the way kind of ghostly that we mentioned earlier. And his effort level is just consistent across every play. It doesn't matter what a team is going to want to do. If he has to close out and then has to guard a guy, they're going down to the rim to recover, to switch back out. He has such a versatile ability to guard guys that it is what you're mentioning of it. If he's on an island, if he has to switch when it comes time, it's not a problem. It's not like going to be something that sends a coach's heart rate rising higher on their Apple Watch. It's going to be something where that's a bit more of a sedative. It calms coaches down that he can be trusted to do that.
This is incredibly reductive, but I think it's illustrative of, you know, the value that Jalen Williams can provide defensively. Again, incredibly reductive, but bear with me for a moment here. I think, you know, there are two sort of main ways in which players get really high steal rates. And the first way is just, you know, incredible hands and incredible ability to read the defense, right? Of like, okay, I know, you know, where they're going to try and get the ball. You know, I have really quick hands and a long enough wingspan that I know when to stick my hand in the passing lane. I can, you know, strip a guy either when he's going up for the shot or, you know, if he dribbles just a bit too close to me, I can grab the ball and run, right? You know, those are the kind of guys where, you know, again, the translation between college steal rate and NBA steal rate is very high. It's like the highest of any of the basic box score statistics. And, you know, again, if there are two primary ways, the one is just, you know, the quick hands and the ability to read passing lanes. And the other is you gamble all the time, right? And, you know, not to be unfair, but to be a little bit unfair, right? I mean, Russell Westbrook had, you know, really high steals numbers for a long time because, you know, he'd get two steals a game and there'd be 10 possessions. And two of them, he steals the ball. And the other eight, it's a, you know, easy trip to the basket for the guy that he tried to steal the ball from. That's not helpful to the defense, right? It's like, okay, you know, getting those, you know, transition opportunities is great, but if you're going 2 for 10, right, you're giving up a lot of the easiest points in the game right around the basket. And so, you know, yes, if Jalen Williams had this exceptional steal rate, if he had, you know, that preternatural ability to just strip the ball away from guys anytime they're, you know, dribbling too close to him, that would be great, but doesn't mean that he's a bad defender by any means, right? It just means that he's not taking those risks. And the reason that he's not taking those risks is because he's staying solid on guys, because he's locked into his assignment, because he's making sure that he's making all the right switches. And so, you know, yes, I have relied on and will continue to rely on high steals rates as, you know, a very strong indicator for potentially good defense, but you have to look into it a little bit more. And sometimes, you know, you see the Russell Westbrook version and other times you see the Jalen Williams version of, okay, maybe he's not getting a lot of steals, but I think I'm much happier with his defense than if, you know, rather than getting, you know, under a steal a game, he's getting a steal and a half per game, but he's doing it by gambling a lot more. Because especially for someone like Williams, who's going to be more of a connective defensive piece than like, you know, he's our lockdown guy, I think it's much more important for him to stay solid and be a part of the scheme rather than I'm going to take a chance on this steal and maybe it blows up in my face.
And it's not like he's not a good like hands defender either. His hands, when he gets them into the cookie jar, when he is like dissuading passes off ball in a deny position or just not getting caught up on screens, like he is the one we saw with blocks. Like he has good hands on defense. It's that he's knowing how to use them. And yeah, you brought up really well of what's really the value of a faux steal percentage that isn't helping a team's defensive concept. That's not a worry that I have after watching all of the film on Jalen Williams playing defense, doing so well off ball where he's contesting without getting his feet out from under him. And that would be something where if he was blocking a lot of threes that it might look good in a highlight, and it the other times when he flies right by it, it is a nightmare for his teammates. No, he has the fundamentals down. He has the impactful defensive play down on the perimeter, and that's what can really get him those 10-12 minutes, as we talked about earlier, on an NBA court earlier than maybe some guys, and probably a handful of guys that go earlier than he does.
Let's talk about the shot, because I think that, you know, it's become a cliche to say the shot will be the swing skill, but I think a better way of putting it is the way that you put it in the article of being a great defender is all good in the NBA, but the days of a potential player like Andre Roberson are gone. If a prospect can't hit shots from deep at a consistent clip, they won't see the floor often. And, you know, there are caveats that apply to all of this, right? You know, there are the centers of the world who you're happy being the one in a four out, one in system. There are the Gary Paytons of the world, Gary Payton II, to be clear, who throw that, you know, on its head and be the shortest guy on the court, but also be the lob threat because you got to do something with them when they're off the ball and they can't shoot, right? But with Jalen, it's kind of similar to the finishing questions, which I think is fun, of like, the shot will not go in a textbook alongside Carmelo Anthony's as beautiful jump shot form, right? But, and this is one that is particularly near and dear to my heart because of Tyrese Haliburton. What matters is if the shot actually goes in. And, you know, especially for Haliburton, you know, there was the concern trolling element and then the, I think, legitimate concern element. And the legitimate concern element, in my mind anyway, was, okay, but can he shoot off the dribble, right? Does his motion make it impossible for him to be someone who can be a valuable, you know, pull up off the dribble guy? And with Jalen Williams, that's not the kind of 3-point shooting that he's going to be making. I mean, Daron Holmes, I know, is a shared favorite of both of ours. And, you know, something that I wrote about earlier this year was, you know, okay, Daron's not pulling off the dribble, right? But what he needs to do for his shot to be valuable is be someone who, if he's the trailer, he can hit a 3-pointer from the wing. If he's initiating the offense from the top of the key and the defense goes, you know, way under on him, he can make that shot if he's got the space, right? That's a lot more important than, you know, wow, Daron Holmes is hitting like 35% of his off the dribble threes when there won't be many NBA teams that are looking for him to do that, right? And I think it's the same sort of principle with Jalen Williams of, okay, you know, maybe the form makes it, you know, difficult to sort of imagine him pulling up off the dribble, especially going to his right, but that's not the kind of shots that you're going to want him to be taking from beyond the arc anyway. And the shots that you do want him to take, maybe it doesn't look as pretty as you'd like it to, but the important part is that it actually goes in the basket, and he's got that part down a lot more than maybe the, you know, textbook form part.
In the way that we've talked about what will get him on the court, regardless of the aesthetics, the spot up shots that he is hitting, and even besides just off of the dribble, I think it was a great point that you brought up with like Haliburton. Besides just off of the dribble, like even off of movement, I wouldn't say Jalen Williams is that threatening of a shooter. That does put a bit of a limitation of you're not going to be running him off of screens as often as other really quality shooters like Dalton in this draft. But just being able to hit the shot that comes to you, especially when you're not the guy creating in the way that the Mavericks role players this postseason have hit the shots that Luka gets for them, I am enjoying the unorthodox nature of Jalen Williams' shot because it has a really quality element that adds to an offense. Shooting it from where he does, hitting 39.5%. I think we've brought this up with prospects when I've been on deep dive before, that we're not always quite sure if this outlier or best shooting season a guy has will hold, but you can even start to go back and look at his numbers from last season, like a crunch down, and at 37%, that's a little bit of an eyebrow raise of, you have a 6'8 guy with plus wingspan. Maybe it's not as fast, maybe it's not as textbook, but what'll get written down in the textbook is if you win, if you are helping to win there. And teams were at times maybe okay with him shooting. That would be in the first half, and with not a fully fleshed out scouting report, teams would try and come down to contest his shots. He isn't, again, a lightning quick releaser. He has a pretty high release point. It is unusual. It can work, and it has worked. It gives me more confidence that it will work with more spacing, even with maybe quicker closeouts and reactions in the NBA. And that really opens up so many possibilities for where and how Jalen could be playing early in his career.
I said earlier that it wouldn't be a deep dives episode if I didn't find a way to shoehorn Isaiah Thomas in. It also wouldn't be a deep dives episode if I didn't find a way to shoehorn in free throw percentage and the way that that's often a stronger indicator of 3-point shooting than, you know, actual 3-point shooting, because, you know, the variance is different. The sample size is usually different. And, you know, with Jalen Williams, I mean, you know, 78% free throw shooter throughout his college career, you know, 83% this past season, which, you know, for me, it's like, when there's an uptick in 3-point percentage that is also tied with an uptick in free throw percentage, I'm more willing to buy into that being just an actual indication of improved shot touch rather than just, you know, something like something we, you know, you brought up Trey Alexander earlier, and I think this is actually perfect for that. Of last year, Trey Alexander was getting a lot of buzz. And part of that was driven by his shooting, of him being a 41% 3-point shooter. And this year, a lot of that buzz has fallen off. And part of that is because he was a 34% 3-point shooter. Last year, Trey Alexander shot 82.4% from the free throw line. This year, Trey Alexander shot, guess what? 82.4% from the free throw line. So that's like, okay, you know, I'm willing to bet because of those numbers that the shot is probably somewhere between that 34% and 41%. And so, you know, again, none of this is indicative in, you know, any sort of guaranteed way, but if someone makes a sizable improvement as a shooter from distance and also a decent improvement at the free throw line, it's easier for me to sort of buy into that as actually this is improved touch rather than, you know, what I've meanly called the Derek Williams principle before of, if you shoot like 40 threes and you hit 56% of them, that doesn't mean you're a 56% 3-point shooter.
Yeah. I think that alongside the Derek Williams, like, it's not a shot, it's a relative great way of a data point to keep track of shooting. It's not like Jalen Williams has small sample size. He's had two legit years as a starter. He's not in the role of a sniper where he's only taking these shots away from the basket, and then you can say, oh, it's been 300 attempts. Oh, it's been this many. We can get a full spectrum view of every single place beyond the arc that he could step. Where is he shooting? How well? But it's not the other end of the spectrum. It's a lot more in the middle, where if you're to blind react, like you sometimes see on NBA draft Twitter, where it's player A versus player B, the player A stats, if they're Jalen Williams' efficiency for shooting, I think you're going to get a lot of votes in that way, because the numbers don't seem like they'll lie in this case. It's not sample size. It's not right out of the blue. It's been slow incremental improvement that's gotten him to be a dangerous shooter from deep. And you can never have too many dangerous shooters from deep who can guard other dangerous shooters from deep and then bring in all other elements of his game and still have places that he can improve if he gets into an NBA system.
So you mentioned earlier the need to maybe throw a bit of cold water on your takes, on your thoughts on Jalen Williams. And I think the best area to do that is this next section, which is, you know, you titled Beyond the Window Dressing, which is maybe a bit more of a negative connotation, and then growth areas, which I think is, you know, a bit of more positive connotation, right? Of, you know, where you hope things can work out. And, you know, I think it's very important to sort of start with the switching stuff, because as we mentioned earlier, the perimeter defense for him is, you know, definitely a positive, but if you're not sort of adept at fitting into a switching scheme, there's only so far you can go with good perimeter defense as a big man. So, you know, for Jalen, I think it's going to be very important for him to be someone who can be a positive cog in a defense in both a switch system and a drop system. Cause, you know, that opens up the versatility for some lineups where he's, you know, a four, or, you know, if he ends up going to the Cleveland Cavaliers, you know, maybe even someone who you play alongside Evan Mobley and Jared Allen, right? And for that to work, then you need to be able to do both. And especially for Williams, who, you know, I think will probably earn his NBA playing time on the defensive end to start, he'll need to be someone who, you know, it doesn't matter as much what kind of defensive scheme the team has, that he can just find a way to fit into that.
I think the same sort of thing really came up in thinking about where he could get better. With any player that you project to be a good switching defender, you don't say that because you're fine with said player being on either a center or a point guard the whole game. You're not going to say, great, now we can fully do musical chairs of who's guarding who outside of the regular 1-1-2-2 way that guys used to match up, but being able to survive not just a random switch like Kevin Love guarding Steph Curry at the end of the finals maybe almost a decade ago. I didn't say how long that was, but you want someone to be able to hold up in a system and not just when the system breaks down. I think that in looking at Jalen Williams, there were some times that smaller players with quick handles could get by him. And obviously that means there are places he can improve. His length lets him recover, but being able to just shift through whatever off-ball actions a defense will run and then getting to do that. And then when they switch to more of a drop system, he can still have that same positive impact. That's where he can still grow. There were a lot of times that Auburn was playing in a zone. That's not uncommon at the college level. I think that NBA teams will recognize the good work that Williams did in that system and then want to see how much can you switch? How can you play a role as that 4 or 5 without as much size? How can you do that to continue to not lock down what we can do on defense, but unlock even more for it?
It's fascinating to me that you bring up that sort of defensive concept of, you know, what he does well being playing in a system, and what he maybe needs to work on is figuring things out when the play works, breaks down. And I think that also is a pretty similar discussion to his passing and his playmaking, where, you know, again, it's the conception of, you know, okay, if, you know, it's a predetermined read, he makes the pass, which is, I think, sort of like what I was talking about earlier with Deron Holmes' shooting. That's the most important part, especially for the archetype of player that he is. Because again, he's not Tyrese Haliburton, right? You don't want him necessarily running the offense. You know, there's self-creation concerns, which we'll get into, but, you know, also just beyond the fact of, you know, he's not a playmaking point guard, so you don't want him to necessarily try and be a playmaking point guard. But, and I think it's particularly important because of how his scoring game is, of, you know, he's someone who, because he's so good at those wonky finishes, because he can, you know, put up a hook shot from 15 feet and, you know, have it drop in a decent amount of the time, if he is someone who, you know, you can rely on to create something out of a broken play with 5 seconds left, that opens up a lot more for him on the offensive end, because it's not just, all right, I'm going to be the fifth guy in whatever offensive scheme I'm part of and, you know, try and earn my playing time on the defensive end and then, you know, be someone who's part of the system on the offensive end. If he can figure that out, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, as you say in the piece, it's hard to become a self-creator this late in one's career, but, you know, if he could, he does have that sort of funky scoring skill set where he could take advantage of it a lot more than most, you know, players of his archetype if he could figure some of that out.
Let's say that he doesn't. I think at times looking at what he is right now as a passer or where a guy is with his skill, just to make sure all is clear in that, he still is a pretty good passer. He still can work from the free throw line. He swings the ball around. He whips it. He hits some backdoor cuts. But as you mentioned, the things he's been schemed to do, I think it's really exciting to imagine what he could be like if his drives were a bit more contained, if he wasn't having to second guess the reads when he's coming downhill as much and being able to keep an offense humming. I think one thing that makes me at least a little more bullish, while I was maybe cautious with my words in the piece, he does not turn the ball over in a way that you'd be a little bit worried of, hey, why don't you take some more ball handling reps? Yeah. He's had an 11.1 and a 10.7 turnover percentage, really tiny numbers. Like, you probably won't even trip over those because of how small they are. And that's something that will help teams be inspired to give him that window to improve. A Jalen Williams who can do a bit more, we're not, in my mind, looking for a massive improvement of self-creation, but being able to be a reliable on-the-fly self-creator in that way, you have just opened it up so much more for him to get minutes and make a positive impact. I think that this thing where going down to the G League for whatever team drafts him, if they want to have him spend some time there, it wouldn't shock me to see it be a different role. He's already fit into a lot of different roles. Why not another? Why not let him start to trial by fire grow in this ball handling or more primary passing role because of the benefits that a team could reap? They know what they're getting from him as a passer. They're getting efficiency and they're getting really straightforward actions. What if they could get more? And that's a really exciting growth area for an older player like Williams.
And I think that leads us perfectly into the conclusion here. And sort of, I think, you know, both circling back to his, you know, some of the previous topics we've talked about, but also sort of, you know, projecting Williams specifically. And this, I think, you know, comes into that discussion with what we were just talking about, because as of right now, you know, as you mentioned, if he never improves as a self-creator, if he never, you know, takes, I mean, I think he'll improve as a switch defender just because I think pretty much all rookies are terrible at defense year one. And then they're, you know, the good defenders figure it out by year two and the bad defenders don't. But, you know, with Williams, I think there's a very interesting element to if he is as he is right now, it's pretty easy for me to see him being the ninth man for a team. If he figures out some of the playmaking stuff, though, that's where I, you know, start to think along the lines of maybe he can climb his way up in a rotation higher than that. Do I think he's going to become an all-star and a 20-point-a-game scorer at some point? No, I don't. I think that if you topped out at 12.5 points a game in college, you're probably not going to be a 20-point-a-game NBA scorer. Well, if you topped out at 12.5 points per game in year five of your college career, I don't think you're likely to be a 20-point-a-game NBA scorer. But, you know, there is this element with, you know, a lot of, we've talked about a lot of these sort of similar prospects where there's a decently high floor of like, okay, you know, the defense is going to translate, you know, whether it's perfectly, you know, translating on the switching side of things or whether it's mostly just, you know, being a good rim protector, then sure, right? But there's the idea of, you know, okay, there are a lot of NBA teams that could use 10 minutes from, say, the 70th odd percentile version of Jalen Williams. But if we get to the 95th percentile version of Jalen Williams and he figures out a lot as a playmaker and a self-creator, you know, then you're not just talking about someone who's a steal at pick 47 because most 47th overall picks don't make it to the NBA. You're talking about this guy's a steal at the 47th pick because, you know, he was an occasional starter and sixth or seventh man for our team for a decade, right? And the first one of those is valuable because, again, getting an NBA player period with, you know, a mid to late second round pick is a huge win. But I think the sleeper agent, you know, to wrap it back to the very beginning, right, the sleeper agent discussion that you brought up is the idea of what if this guy just doesn't end up on any boards and then, you know, pick a team, right? Like, let's say Dallas takes him with the last pick of the draft and he comes in and, you know, he takes, you know, 5 minutes a game from Derek Jones Jr. and 7 minutes a game from PJ Washington and establishes himself as a rotation player quickly. And then, you know, Derek Jones Jr. moves on and all of a sudden Jalen Williams is a surprise starter for the Dallas Mavericks, right? Is that entirely out of the question for his 95th percentile outcome? And again, I'm saying 95th percentile for a reason, right? Because it requires some growth. And particularly with self-creation stuff, growth in an area where you don't usually see players of his age fulfill that, you know, yeah, maybe it's unlikely, but if you've got someone who's got this, you know, rock solid floor that he does of positive complementary player on both ends of the floor, if he does go down to the G League and spend that time, as you mentioned, with the ball in his hands and figures out some of that self-creation stuff, then you're talking about someone who goes from like a steal of the draft to the steal of the draft.
Especially where he is going to be mocked at or looked at in the draft. Getting the steal of the draft is something that teams would really, you know, every team would want the steal of the draft. If they're going to get a 95% outcome player on all of their picks, that would be wonderful. If they get a 50%, the median expected Jalen Williams at pick 47, that's still an organizational win. That's still a win for your rotation. That's one fewer question mark that you'd need to have to answer outside of your organization from free agency. It's another player that you can put into your system. you can start to build upon a foundation. And I just wonder why there's as much snoozing going on for a player like Jalen Williams. The more modern that the NBA gets, the more mathematically charged a lot of the defensive and offensive possessions get, the more teams will need to find guys in the second round who can play a role that, again, it's not going to be a star role, but it's going to be an important role. And for a guy like Jalen Williams, I'm not going to bemoan the 2024 draft class as a whole because I don't subscribe to the notion that it's a poor draft class in the way people say. It's a little more uncertain. He offers some certainty in what he can do now. If he can break that certainty in a good way for what he can do later, it's even better. And I do think after things have shaken out, teams are going to be a little more enticed by that certainty they can get from a sleeper agent like Jalen Williams.
I think this is also an important element, and I can't tell where this falls along the lines of cynicism versus optimism. I think it's a lot of both, honestly, but I think NBA teams are just smarter than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And saying that as the fan of the Sacramento Kings, who now I would say has quite a smart front office when they used to have a spectacularly stupid front office, right? It's like, you know, I think part of the reason that, you know, the Jay Crowders of the world, the Tumani Kamaras of the world, you know, these older college players who, yeah, maybe they weren't ever the focal point of the offense. Maybe they weren't ever even the focal point of the defense. But if we need, you know, a seventh, eighth man who we're comfortable can just play basketball at a high level, I think that bodes very well for Jalen Williams' chances of being drafted because, you know, I think maybe 10 years ago, it's just, well, this guy never scored more than 12.5 points a game in college and he's 24 years old. Why are we looking at drafting him? It's like, well, because not everybody on your team is going to score 20 points a game. That's not how basketball works, right? Like you can't have 12 guys scoring 20 points a game. And if you did, then none of the rest of this would matter because you'd be blowing out every team that you ever played, right? It's like, given that that's not how it works, you know, the question becomes, okay, well, if we have, you know, our superstar and our second star and, you know, our third starter in the pecking order offensively, you know, then it's a question of, okay, who can we get who they'll come off the bench and they'll fit well with our top three guys and they can, you know, fill out multiple different roles in multiple different bench lineup constructions, right? Like I semi-facetiously mentioned the, if Jalen Williams goes to the Cavs, he's a small forward, but you know, that kind of notion I think works in the sense of, look, if you're a team that, you know, needs someone who can mesh with the star guys. And, you know, for some players, it'll be, you know, maybe take more of an offensive role when they come off the bench. For some guys, it's maybe just, no, you're going to plug gaps whenever you play. But if you're someone who can fit in with the starters and fit in with the bench guys, you're going to find a role. And, you know, Tumani Kamara did that to the point where he became a starter pretty quickly in Portland. But even if you don't hit that kind of outcome, you know, if you're getting someone, I believe Tumani Kamara was the 53rd overall pick. I might not be 100% correct on that, but somewhere in the 50s, right? If you get someone like Tumani Kamara, like Jalen Williams could be somewhere in the 50s, the whole rest of your team makes a whole lot more sense because, you know, everybody can slot into a role that makes more sense for them. If you have someone who, you know, their sort of raison d'etre, as it were, is to come in and fill all the gaps.
And to add on to your point, not only does Williams have that skill set, he's done it before. Yes. It's not new territory for him to be very role malleable. That's something that shouldn't be overlooked. It shouldn't be taken as a minus in any way that he's like lost out on those starter minutes, because once you understand the context, it becomes he is ready to do what your team needs to win. And I'll say it again, if you're getting a second round guy that will help you to win games, what NBA team wouldn't want that?
I don't think we can end on a better note than that, but just in case, anything else before we wrap this one up?
I'll let that note play out.
All right. Well, he is Rowan Kent. You can find him on Twitter at Rowan Kent. And you can, of course, find his written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. Be sure to check out all of Rowan's great work, but also be sure to check out the piece that he wrote on Jalen Williams that came out yesterday by the time all of you are listening to this. Although I am curious about the person who would listen to this episode and not actually read the article, but whatever. You do you, people of the world who follow No Ceilings. And speaking of which, you can follow No Ceilings on all social media platforms at No Ceilings NBA and find us on YouTube at No Ceilings TV. You can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That is always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dive specific portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Thank you.